China, and then I was teaching in the University of Hong Kong,
okay.
And was trained in Cornell New York Hospital, Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital,
okay.
New York City.
Yeah, very reputable hospital, Sloan Kettering, huh?
Right.
And yeah.
And I was on the McGill University,
McGill.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's pretty reputable. In Canada, right?
Yeah.
So McGill and Sloan Kettering actually are two of the big hospitals in North America that research cancer.
Right.
Other stuff too, but they're renowned for cancer.
Right.
Right.
Actually, the American medicine came from McGill.
From McGill. Okay. Interesting.
So
you spent a lot of time there at both of those places?
I spent 3 years as an assistant professor at McGill.
Okay. Okay.
And then I went to Yale. As associate professor in 1971.
To Yale?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was on the faculty for many years.
So you've been around at some reputable institutions here
in
North America.
Yeah, well, I was, in the meantime, I was practicing hospital pathology as well.
Okay.
So teaching, practicing, and research in pathology.
Okay, very good. So you, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about specifically today, and it does have to do with pathology, is the Gardasil vaccine.
Yes.
So I know you're very knowledgeable about that. Share with us some of your research on Gardasil.
Well, I came into the Gardasil vaccine just by accident. You know, my main purpose in pathology is to find out why people get sick, why people die, and how they die and how they get sick.
Yeah.
You know? So I developed methods to diagnose HPV accurately.
Okay.
Yeah. So that based on my publication, some of the women who felt their daughters might be hurt, injured by the HPV vaccination.
Yeah.
And they contact me, and see whether Dr. Lee could find something, in the vaccine. So.
Okay.
So it was.
So they came to you asking you. They knew that you were an expert at HPV. They wanted to see
maybe
the vaccine had injured their daughter.
Right, because nobody else wanted to listen to what their opinions are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they just found my reputation in terms of publication.
Yeah.
They said, "Could you help?"
Okay. So what did you find out when you started looking into that?
Well, initially, I didn't want to get involved into it because I thought it was unlikely to find anything in a vaccine in terms of HPV DNA.
Right.
Because the manufacturing and FDA already said that all the DNA has been removed and it should not have any residual viral DNA left there.
Okay.
Right. But one of the mothers showed me a report, actually, from Toronto.
Okay.
And said, look, my daughter's blood had HPV DNA in it. And the report came from a Toronto independent lab.
Okay.
Yeah. And my daughter was 13 years old. And she was sexually not active, right? And there was no way for her to get HPV infection.
Except
for the vaccine.
Okay.
So I saw the report. Yeah. So I talked to the PhD who did the test in Toronto, and he convinced me that he did find HPV DNA in it. So.
Okay.
So the first thing I said, okay, in that case, I have to test the vaccine first, right? And see whether the HPV vaccine indeed contained any HPV DNA in it.
Okay.
Right. If they didn't contain any HPV DNA, there's no point for me to look for anything else in
right.
Right? So
you tested the vaccine then?
Right, I tested the vaccine.
Then did you find?
There are many mothers, in New Zealand, In Australia, I think, I don't know Australia, but in New Zealand, in America, in some European country.
You know,
okay. So they send the specimen to me to test. So I test every one of them good.
Okay.
HPV DNA.
So all of them had HPV DNA in them?
Yeah, the ones I tested.
Okay.
Yeah, they all have it.
And this is after the FDA said that they don't contain any DNA.
Right, yeah. The manufacturers said that, right. After they said that, right.
So then what conclusion can you draw from that? What does that mean?
When you have a free viral DNA, yeah, in a vaccine, and that contains aluminum, yeah, and the when HPV DNA molecules are bound to the aluminum, and that new complex may be potentially risky, yeah, when you inject to the human being. So that's why. And also at the same time that one of the girl who died, you know, in New Zealand, and they got a court order to send the post-mortem specimen to mm-hmm. me to analyze.
Okay.
Then I found the HPV 16 viral DNA left in the blood of the post-mortem material and in the spleen as well.
So the autopsy showed HPV DNA.
Right.
So is that what does that mean? Does that mean that it's likely that they died from the vaccine? What is the conclusion?
I think most likely from the vaccine, because this, you know, and usually the vaccine DNA, when they bind with aluminum, yeah, they change the conformation to so-called non-B conformation, and the HPV DNA left in the autopsy material.
Okay.
Was in non-B conformation, and that means the DNA I found in the post-mortem material was not a natural DNA from the virus.
Okay.
So it's most likely from the vaccine.
Okay. So.
So yeah, I published a paper.
You published a paper on that, right?
Yeah, okay. I published a paper.
And did you get any kind of backlash from the paper?
No. Actually, nobody. Nobody challenged the data, but the paper was rejected several times, and it could not be published in, you know, the usual American mainstream journal. So, but eventually it was published in a peer review scientific journal.
Okay.
Even the discovery of HPV DNA in a vaccine was rejected several times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's it's a problem for people who try to publish this kind of material.
Talk about that. So it's sometimes if you publish something like this that's against the grain, you can't.
Right. It's very hard for the scientists to publish paper that indicated there's something wrong in the HPV vaccination or in the vaccine. Yeah. And personally, I have a lot of this. Experience. I call it basically is global editorial censorship.
Global editorial censorship.
Basically, that's it.
Well, I guess there's no other way to describe it. If they won't publish something that's been heavily researched, and you've proven from analyzing the postmortem, you've analyzed the vaccines, I mean, it's not really up for debate.
Right, but the facts are there.
You found what you found.
Right. What the significance, you can argue what it means.
Right.
Right. But I just wanted to say, look, I found something.
And they didn't even want to publish the fact that you found the HPV DNA.
Right, they didn't want to.
Okay.
Because they would be, the excuse is nobody, they said that people are not interested in reading something like this.
Oh, really?
Right?
That's bizarre to me that people wouldn't be interested to know that the HPV vaccine could be responsible for killing someone.
Right.
I would think they would want to know that.
Right. They don't do this.
Okay.
So basically, when you look at the editorial boards, you know, many of these are heavily affiliated with the manufacturer. That's obvious.
Okay. So in other words, the advertising in the journals dictates what content they contain.
Right.
The advertisers.
Basically.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Because they have to worry about their advertisement too, right? Their revenues, they come from you know, the pharmaceutical company or that, right? It's supported. Yeah.
So there is potentially a conflict of interest there.
Oh yeah, it's editorial policy.
Okay. So it's not just potential, it's policy.
Basically, I think.
Okay.
I think the editorial policy.
Dr. Lee, if you could talk about the Joe Gomez case. You're very familiar with this. Explain what happened.
Right. The Joe Gomez case was that the lawyer contacted me.
Okay. Yeah,
and asked me to review a case. Yeah. And the lawyer said that there's a 13 or 14-year-old boy, you know, who died after the second injection of Gardasil.
Okay.
In sleep at night. You know, and the medical examiner said, you know, it was myocardial infection, some sort.
Okay. A heart attack.
Heart attack.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. And in 13, 14-year-old boy, heart attack, as a pathologist, I never heard of.
Yeah. You never heard of that?
In a 40-year-old, 50, 60, 80 years, it's common, possible, right? In a 14-year-old, die in sleep.
I've never heard of a 14-year-old dying of a heart attack.
Right. I said, okay, I review it, yeah, if it's the case. So I look at the case, and I look at the pathology section of the heart, and to me it's obviously is myocardial infarction, you know, MI, myocardial infarction.
Okay.
Like the old man, you know, got the heart attack, you got infarct. Yeah. So I said, and then there's no coronary obstruction.
Okay.
And there was the boy was a football, training for football, playing in high school.
Okay, so he was in good shape.
Yeah, he was in good shape. And the boy was followed by the pediatrician from birth.
Okay.
Yeah. There's no question about the healthy problems. No health issue at all.
Okay.
Yeah, regularly followed by the pediatricians and documented. And he was injected with one dose of Gardasil. In June or something, and then no problem, and then continue play football. Then 2 months later, and the boy was injected with a second dose of Gardasil, and then went home, and he told his mother that he was not feeling well. He went to sleep. Mm. And next morning, dead.
He never woke up.
Never woke up. Mm. Yeah. So that, so the lawyers told me to review the case. So I read, I saw it, and I think this potentially, I think this most likely due to Gardasil vaccination on the second part, and the first injection probably induced a silent heart attack. Yeah, and the boy was physically good enough, not feeling it. Maybe some discomfort, but he continued to be active in sport. Yeah. But the second Gardasil in the afternoon, in a few hours, and that may cause the problem the second time.
Wow.
In an already physically damaged heart. Yeah.
So the first Gardasil vaccine damaged his heart, most likely. The second one killed him.
Right.
Wow, that's so. Yeah. I don't even understand why we're giving Gardasil shots to boys. Why are they giving them to boys?
Well, that's controversial. This boys. If you eliminated the HPV infection in the boys, then the girls would not get it. Yeah, that was the rationale behind it.
Okay,
but it's a debatable.
Okay, it sounds to me just personally like it's just a way to sell more vaccines.
Yeah, it's possible. and actually, that from the very beginning, as a pathologist, I have reading Pap smear for cervical cancer prevention all my life. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think there's a need for a vaccine, you know, to prevent HPV infection at all. Yeah, there's no need to it, because the Pap smear. The cervical cancer screening program by the gynecologist, are adequate to prevent cervical cancer in American women, as long as they are under gynecologic care, you know, regularly. And actually, no one should die of cervical cancer in the United States. And this is not only my opinion. This is everybody agree, you know. Yeah, because cervical cancer is one cancer that can be prevented by regular screening.
Okay.
The vaccine is only at a cost, because all the women who receive vaccination have to undergo regular gynecology checkup anyway.
Right.
So why you add another cost?
Do the Pap smear.
Yeah, but, yeah, you just do the Pap smear and regular HPV accurate testing. Mm-hmm. You know, for screening.
So, but and no one that I know of has ever died from a Pap smear.
Right,
right,
right. Pap smear, right. Pap smear is very right. It's safe. No one dies of it. Right.
Yeah,
it's safe. Right.
As opposed to the Gardasil vaccine, which is potentially deadly.
Right. That, or even it's not deadly. If you cause a teenage girl some illness that prevent or delay the schooling, right, and turn a grade A student to grade C student. Yeah, because loss of schooling, that's already not good.
That's a huge damage.
That's already damaged, right? And then they admitted that 2 to 3% of these girls may develop serious adverse reactions. That means hospitalization, sickness, visiting emergency room doctor. Even they don't die, right? Even if they don't have a permanent damage, but just the delay of schooling for a few months or 2 years is not good.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal for the girl.
Yeah.
You are talking about 2 to 3%.
That's a pretty big percentage.
Right. When this were healthy girls.
Yeah.
Right? And you prevented cancer, which may or may not happen 30, 40 years down the road. Mm. Right?
You look at the risk versus the benefit, don't you?
Right. So I wrote an argument against the developer of the cancer in National Cancer Institute in the openly questioned it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did it say?
They don't say anything, but they just prevent cancer.
Okay. Right. That's it.
Basically, that I think there's an issue here should be debated openly.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the issue with, that's the issue that everyone wants, is just to have an open debate vaccines, about Gardasil.
My opinion may not be right, right?
But let's at least talk about it.
Let's talk about it from the pathology point of view.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But the censorship is bothering.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's an open discussion. Ought to have an open discussion.
Right. And as you mentioned earlier, it's kind of a global censorship.
Right. And my articles could not be published because we rejected this. The editor doesn't even send the article out for review. Mm. The editor is not specialist. The peer reviewers are the specialists. Basically, when ordinary, commonly, customarily, when you send an article and manuscript to a journal, the editors look at the journal, look at your manuscript, the editor look at the manuscript, and then refer to the experts. That's called peer reviewers. The peer reviewers are the experts. But they stop at the editorial level. They don't send the manuscripts out for peer review. That is the problem. And even in one article, the first article I tried to publish the HPV DNA in the vaccine, the editor sent out for peer review, and all three peer reviewers say, this manuscript could be or should be reported, should be published. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then after the agreement for publication, the editor find a reason to reject it. Mm. That's editorial censorship.
I got it. So that just to make sure that I'm clear. So here we have you, Dr. Lee. You've been at Memorial Sloan Kettering. You've been at McGill. You've taught at Yale. You're a pathologist. You analyze the HPV vaccine. You find DNA in it. The article goes through peer review, and then all of a sudden, the editor says, "Oh no, we're not going to publish it."
Right, not publish it.
Was there a particular reason that they wouldn't publish a peer-reviewed article?
No, sometimes they They find all kinds of reasons, editorial reasons. But they usually the editor does not want to disagree or contradict the conclusions of the peer reviewers, usually, because they are the peer.
Right.
Right? The editor usually go along with it. Yeah. But they will find any other reasons, non-scientific reasons.
Okay. To
turn it down. Then I have to submit it to another journal. And yeah. Fortunately, I find another editor who's more sympathetic.
And you found a journal to find
right, and publish it. You know.
So do you think, that just your opinion, like on the first journal that rejected the article that was already peer-reviewed,
right.
Do you think that it potentially was because of a conflict of interest with the advertisers in the journal or the
fixing
companies?
Yeah, it's just policy. It's probably just some editors in the board, right? You just don't know who they are, right? There are names on it, right? They just, okay, they have the policy. They have decided whether they publish or not.